Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on Attorney General Curtis Hill. Donald Trump Jr. swung by the Hoosier State to rally for several GOP candidates ahead of the midterm election. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Donna Stuckert with Porter County Waste and Recycling. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. An ex-school district superintendent charged with double billing the district for about $1,200 in expenses will be able to travel in Illinois as the case moves forward. The Post Tribune reports 55-year-old Cheryl Pruitt made her first court appearance Monday after the former Gary Community School superintendent was charged last month with felony theft and official misconduct. She told a magistrate she understood the charges against her. Pruitt resigned as superintendent in February after an emergency manager took over the district as it faced more than $100 billion in debt. Pruitt's attorney, Scott King, had asked the magistrate to expand an order allowing her to travel for work. Since April, Pruitt has worked as CEO of Chicago Virtual Charter School. Court documents say Pruitt told an investigator the double billing wasn't done intentionally. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has asked a federal judge to give it access to 9 East Chicago properties at the USS Lead Superfund site that haven't been checked for lead or arsenic. The Post Tribune reports the EPA on Monday filed for administrative warrants that would allow them to sample the soil at 9 properties in Zone 3 of the Superfund site in the East Calumet neighborhood, as staff has not been able to get permission from owners for the tests. The EPA said that knowing that hazardous substances have been found at other properties, it gives them, quote, reasonable basis to seek court-ordered access. The agency said the only way to know if the 9 properties have high levels of lead or arsenic is to test the soil. According to court documents, at 3 properties, the owners refused to grant the EPA access, 2 were non-responsive, and 4 were listed as abandoned with owners that could not be contacted. The EPA began securing access agreements in 2014, according to court filings. Of the 481 properties in Zone 3, the EPA had access to 472 and sampled in 468. The EPA found that 289 of those needed remediation. According to court filings, the EPA expected to remediate 278 of the 289 properties by the end of this year. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. State regulators have set 2 public hearings on Indiana American Water's request for a rate hike to help pay for infrastructure upgrades. Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission scheduled the hearings for November 7th at Seymour High School and November 26th at Gary City Hall. Both hearings will start at 6 p.m. local time. The utility, with more than 300,000 Indiana customers, is seeking a nearly 17% rate increase to help pay for more than $542 million of infrastructure investments. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill won't face criminal charges after an investigation into sexual misconduct allegations against him. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on a special prosecutor's announcement Tuesday.
The Indiana Inspector General interviewed 56 witnesses into the March incident at which 4 women say the Attorney General improperly groped them. Hill did not meet with investigators. Instead, he submitted a video statement through his attorneys. Special Prosecutor Dan Sigler says he won't bring a criminal case.
You can imagine in a crowded bar at 2:30 in the morning, well, actually it was from midnight to 5:30 in the morning, where people were in and out and the alcohol was free, and so that was one of the difficulties, frankly. There's no timeline for me to prove. There's no ability to say this happened at this time, this person was here and that person was there. That was just impossible.
In a statement, Hill's attorneys say the investigation exonerates their client. The 4 women are moving forward with a civil case against Hill. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb says his position on Attorney General Curtis Hill has not changed following the investigation into allegations that he groped four women at a party in March. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports Holcomb says he cannot tell the legislature to impeach Hill.
Governor Eric Holcomb says recent investigations validate the women who came forward with sexual misconduct allegations against Attorney General Curtis Hill. Three investigations have now found the allegations credible, though none of them determined Hill's actions were criminal. But Holcomb says he doesn't have the authority to tell the legislature to impeach Hill. He says he can only offer his personal opinion.
I believe that resignation would be the proper course now that this has been confirmed three times.
In recent statements, House Speaker Brian Bosma and Senator David Long also reaffirmed their positions that Hill should step down. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Legislative leaders reiterated their calls for Attorney General Curtis Hill to resign after a special prosecutor announced Tuesday Hill won't face criminal charges. Four women, a state lawmaker, and three legislative staffers say Hill groped them at a party in March. An investigation by the Indiana Inspector General reports three other women, lobbyists, say Hill acted inappropriately with them as well. Hill denies touching anyone inappropriately. Legislative leaders say they believe the women and call on Hill to step down, as they did when the allegations first became public in July. Hill's attorneys say the Republican official is exonerated and absolved.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Four women who say Attorney General Curtis Hill improperly groped them at a party are taking initial steps to bring a civil case against the Republican official. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports that comes after a special prosecutor announced Hill won't face criminal charges from the incident.
An inspector general's report on allegations against Curtis Hill says multiple witnesses report Hill's conduct was, quote, inappropriate, creepy, and unwelcome, but a special prosecutor says he can't prove a crime was committed. Gabrielle McLemore is one of the four women who publicly accused Hill.
What has happened here today has told women that when we come forward, that when we share what happens to us, that, you know, we can be believed, but that doesn't really mean anything.
Nikki DeSilva, another alleged victim, says that's why they're exploring a civil case against Hill for harassment, discrimination, and retaliation.
I think this is a message to other women that they can stand up for themselves, too.
Hill denies he touched anyone inappropriately. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A lawmaker has requested a formal ethics hearing regarding allegations that House Speaker Brian Bosma spent $40,000 in campaign funds to gather unflattering information about a former intern who says she had a sexual encounter with him in the early 1990s. In a letter Monday, Representative Linda Lawson asked House Ethics Committee Chairman Greg Steuerwald for a public meeting to determine if Bosma's actions violated House ethics rules. Those rules require every Hoosier member to campaign and serve, quote, with a personal commitment to integrity and dedicated public service focused on the best interests of the citizens of the state. Lawson noted that Bosma spent, quote, nearly as much as the average Hoosier worker earns in a year to investigate and compile information on the former intern, and that, quote, the woman and members of her family felt as though the investigation was an effort to intimidate her from speaking out. Bosma did not immediately respond to a message left with his spokeswoman. But he has previously denied the sexual encounter occurred. His attorney, Linda Pence, said she conducted a professional investigation on Bosma's behalf and did not threaten or intimidate anyone. The House Ethics Committee, which includes three Republicans and three Democrats, rarely meets publicly.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's highly contested U.S. Senate race drew a top-tier Republican booster Monday, Donald Trump Jr. The president's son rallied with several GOP candidates in Greenfield, Indiana. That includes Senate candidate Mike Braun, 6th Congressional District hopeful Greg Pence, and the statewide ticket of Secretary of State Connie Lawson, Auditor Tara Klutz, and Treasurer Kelly Mitchell. Trump implored the crowd to help get people to vote.
Let's put some leaders in there who know how to get it done. Let's put some guys who know how to grow businesses. Let's put some people who, when they talk about employment, have actually done it.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Recent polling data from the Mike Down Center for Indiana Politics suggests incumbent Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly is neck and neck with Republican candidate Mike Braun across the state in the Senate race. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barb Aguiano has more.
A total of 1,400 Hoosier adults were surveyed, with about 800 of the 1,400 likely to vote. The poll looked at factors that may influence elections, including age, gender, political and religious affiliation, income, education, race, and the type of community they live in. The poll says Donnelly has a slight advantage over Braun, but 11% of undecided voters could change that. Director of the Down Center, Andy Downs, says while Indiana is not traditionally a swing state, the number of established politicians who have campaigned for the Senate candidates has also had an effect on the closeness of the race.
The last two Senate races in Indiana got a lot of attention nationally. Neither of them ended up being as close as people were forecasting they would be earlier on in the year. This is getting pretty late to still be this tight.
About 8% of those surveyed favored Libertarian candidate Lucy Brenton. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barb Anguiano.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention don't know why children are coming down with a rare condition that causes weakness and paralysis in the arms and legs. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Eldana reports Midwest states have 40% of all confirmed cases in the U.S.
There are 10 confirmed cases of acute flaccid myelitis, or AFM, in Illinois. Indiana, Ohio, Missouri, and Kentucky each have a case so far. Most of the cases have affected children who are 4 years old. Dr. John Christensen is a professor of clinical pediatrics at Riley's Children's Health. He says children could be more at risk because they have a weaker immune system.
What happens is that with time, you build immunity. As an adult, you're probably less likely to have symptoms due to one of these viruses than if you were a young child.
Doctors say it's hard to diagnose AFM. It starts off as a common cold and can't be diagnosed through normal methods like blood work. The CDC is reporting 62 confirmed AFM cases nationwide, with 155 under investigation. I'm Araceli Gomez-Aldana for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Healthcare is a top issue in the race for the U.S. Senate seat in Indiana, and pre-existing conditions is one of the buzzwords. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports on what candidates Joe Donnelly and Mike Braun are saying about pre-existing condition coverage for Hoosiers who receive insurance on the individual market. In Indiana, that's about 167,000 people, and those protections could be at risk.
The majority of people in Indiana have health insurance coverage through their employer or a government plan like Medicaid and Medicare. The Affordable Care Act, or ACA, opened a market for others, including those who work part-time or for a small company. It also made it illegal for insurance companies to deny coverage or increase rates because of a pre-existing condition. In a phone call this week, Republican candidate Mike Braun says if he wins, he will support ACA repeal efforts but preserve some of the most popular parts of the plan in a replacement.
The key part of it's got to be cover pre-existing conditions, no cap on coverage, and affordable.
In an email this week, Democratic incumbent Joe Donnelly rebuked a recent federal move to give states the ability to establish short-term plans that do not have to follow ACA rules, including coverage of pre-existing conditions. Indiana has currently signed on to a federal lawsuit to overturn the ACA. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Purdue University has announced there will be no changes for the moment in the school's spousal health coverage policy. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the decision comes after employees balked at a proposal to drop coverage on spouses who can receive health coverage from their workplace.
In an email sent to employees Tuesday morning, Purdue University Treasurer Bill Sullivan announced that while no changes will be made now, the current spousal policy will be reviewed over the next 6 months. The statement claims the university spends more than $4 million annually for spouses who could receive health insurance from their employers. Here's Sullivan.
We are subsidizing those employers by having the spouses remain on our plan.
Sullivan says the change would have only impacted spouses with employers that would cover 50% or more of the person's health care premium. A town hall-style meeting organized by staff members will still take place Wednesday. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Seema Verma, administrator for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, was in Indianapolis Monday to promote changes to Medicare. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports Verma's visit comes during the open enrollment season.
Medicare open enrollment started this week. CMS Administrator Seema Verma stopped at a senior living facility to talk about changes, including more plans and new supplemental benefits.
So it could be something small like a ride to the doctor's office. It could be some in-home help, maybe some nutritional services. But the idea is, you know, providing as much flexibility so that plans can provide personalized healthcare services to the recipients.
Verma talked to residents and answered questions about a new online platform, new cards, and advantages of comparison shopping. Verma also talked about Marketplace open enrollment for plans through the Affordable Care Act. That begins November 1st. She touted stabilized prices and more insurer options. Both programs together provide health insurance for more than 2.5 million Hoosiers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A state committee is recommending sweeping changes to rules for virtual charter schools in Indiana. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the group reached general agreement Monday on a proposed list of policy recommendations.
Three members from the State Board of Education make up the committee. They've listened to experts and gathered data for months after years of failing virtual charter schools prompted concerns, including from the governor's office. Now the group has a somewhat final list of recommended policy changes. Committee Chair Gordon Hendry says immediate action can start to fix what he calls a broken system.
There is a place for virtual education in the state of Indiana, but it has really not been regulated well.
Committee members want to see a single virtual charter school authorizer and changes to slow the rapid growth of those schools. Hendry says the committee will present its final set of recommendations to the state board next month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indianapolis doctor is featured in a new documentary that highlights the history of an all-black hospital in St. Louis. Dr. Earl Robertson Jr.'s father was also a doctor, one of the first interns at the hospital. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan sat down with Robinson to talk about the impact and significance of that hospital, the Homer G. Phillips Hospital in St. Louis, ahead of the Indianapolis screening of The Color of Medicine.
What was this hospital?
My dad was a physician. Before me, he was in the first group of interns at Homer G. Phillips Hospital. The unique thing about Homer Phillips Hospital, it was a all-black hospital built for the citizens, the black citizens of St. Louis back in 1937. My dad and a group of interns that finished from Meharry Medical College in Nashville, Tennessee, didn't even know about Homer Phillips. They were on their way to Kansas City to a hospital there. When they changed trains in St. Louis, a red cap, these are the people that put bags on and off the train, asked them where they were going. They said, well, we're going to Kansas City. Say, we're doctors. We just finished from medical school. He said, well, they just built a new colored hospital here. They said, well, we're paying $10 a month, room and board with uniforms. They called other guys, said, catch a cab. We're going to stay here. No point in going to Kansas City. They're the first class of interns at Homer Phillips Hospital.
What do you think was the impact of having a hospital like that at the time?
Well, if you go back historically, back in the 1930s, there were only 25 black specialists in the whole country of the United States. There were like 19,000 white. So there was discrepancy because of segregation and prejudice, because there weren't any training programs. You couldn't be a surgeon because there was no place for you to go. So because of this, this became one of the premier's training programs.
I would imagine that he inspired you to become a doctor.
Later on in life, we moved to Evansville, Indiana. The house was half office and half house. So I was around medicine from the very time I was 5 or 6 years old, you know.
When we talk about health and race often something that we're still talking about today.
True.
The disparity of being able to access care, of healthy outcomes.
Correct.
Why is this story so important today?
Well, you have to realize, I go back to the time when this was so segregated. Even after Homer Phillips opened, it was a segregated hospital. And when I went to medical school at Indiana University from 1958 to 1963, hospitals were segregated. Blacks were in the basement of Methodist Hospital. Blacks were segregated at Wishart Hospital. Blacks were segregated at IU's Hospital. The only integration I saw was at Raleigh Hospital because they had a professor and chairman of the department named Dr. Meeks, who said, I don't have any color barrier. All babies are the same.
When the Homer G. Phillips Hospital closed in 1979,
correct.
Was it the closing of an era?
Oh, it was contentious closing because of the city. It was politics, there was financing. There are a lot of things, and it's still a sore spot in the city. That's why it's so popular now with this film, because the fact that the hospital had such an impact on the community and what blacks accomplished.
You talk about politics
right.
And the healthcare system.
Still going on, right?
What lessons can we learn?
One thing you have to realize, medicine is not for a few, it's for everyone. And healthcare should be universal. Everyone deserves to have universal health care. In fact, the amount of monies that are spent on health care could be drastically reduced if the costs weren't so high. One of the main costs are pharmaceuticals. The second is the technology, because the days when I finished medical school, I could diagnose what was happening in someone's chest, like pneumonia or heart problem, with a stethoscope.
It's really, really great to have you in today. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. October marks the start of flu season in the U.S. More than half of all states, including Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, and Missouri, have laws regarding flu shots for healthcare workers. And a new change in Illinois law should make it harder for employees to decline the vaccine. But some on the front lines of public health worry the law has no teeth. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman reports.
The new Illinois statute essentially requires all healthcare workers at hospitals and long-term care facilities to get the flu shot. Employers have to offer the vaccine to employees, and employees have to take it unless they've already gotten the flu shot elsewhere or
unless they have a religious objection or if they have some sort of medical problem that would be complicated by getting the vaccine.
That's one of the law's lead sponsors, Democratic State Senator Bill Cunningham of Chicago. He says the old law wasn't clear on what kinds of exemptions were allowed.
They basically allowed for employees of hospitals to use just their personal convictions as a legitimate reason to deny an influenza vaccine.
That, he says, created conflicts between the hospitals that wanted everyone vaccinated and employees who didn't want to get the flu shot. The new law allows healthcare facilities to take disciplinary action against anyone who declines the vaccine without a medical or religious exemption. Cunningham says that could mean a suspension or even getting fired.
I don't think any hospital wants to get to that point, and I think that they feel like having the law clarified will help them avoid those kind of conflicts.
Dr. Nirav Shah directs Illinois' Department of Public Health. His agency licenses the more than 3,000 health facilities affected by these new rules. He says these stricter flu shot requirements are important in light of last year's particularly deadly flu season. It claimed an estimated 80,000 lives across the U.S. That's according to the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in an interview with the Associated Press. And the flu shot hospitalized 900,000 more.
Healthcare workers are at ground zero. They are often coming into contact with other individuals who might have the flu and then could potentially transmit it to another patient.
The goal, Shaw says, is to stop that. But some on the front lines of public health worry the law won't do that. That's because it doesn't require anyone to track whether healthcare facilities are doing what's now required of them. Julie Pride leads the Champaign-Urbana Public Health Department.
If there's no follow-up, look at something as simple as a speed limit sign. If you know that there's nobody checking up on you, people aren't going to follow it.
Shaw says his agency will conduct regular facilities inspections, and checking up on flu shot programs could be a part of that. But Pride says the law would be more effective if it allowed public health officials at the state level to work with local departments like hers to do more thorough enforcement. Danny Chun is a spokesman for the Illinois Health and Hospital Association. He points out that flu shot rates for hospital workers are already pretty high nationwide, 92%, according to the CDC.
Hospitals and healthcare workers are very aware of the risks and dangers of the influenza season.
But for employees at long-term care facilities like nursing homes, the nationwide flu shot rate is much lower, at 67%. That's why Pride says it's so important to make sure the facilities are in fact requiring flu shots.
If people see this law in the news, they're going to assume that their loved ones are being protected, when in fact, it may not be.
Shaw says his agency has already done what the law requires, write the new rules and notify facilities about them.
So the implementation and execution of this program is really left now to the facilities.
State Senator Cunningham says he doesn't anticipate compliance will be an issue, but if it is, he's open to amending the law further. But Pride's question remains, if no one's checking, how will people really know healthcare workers are getting the flu shot? I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Donna Stuckert of Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction.
Let's check in with Donna Stuckert, who is with the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction in Valparaiso. And Donna, we haven't chatted for a while, so there are a lot of things on the plate, so to speak, let's take up today. And some of them are recycling and some of them are composting and related. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start out first with an interesting concept here. I guess we know this is autumn, which of course means we have a time zone change coming up here before long. And I know we, of course, always talk about changing your clocks, moving your clocks back an hour, fall back and spring ahead, as the phrase goes. And one of the good ideas is to also check the batteries in your smoke detector at the same time, too. But you also know, too, something interesting about not only changing batteries, but maybe even just changing smoke detectors altogether. And that's going to lead into a very special event coming up in Porter County. Tell us about it.
Well, we have smoke detector recycling, and that's available to all Porter County residents. And we ask that, you know, when you're checking your batteries and if you notice that your smoke detector no longer works, or if you flip it over and you see the manufacturer date is 10 years or older, that you bring them in to be recycled. And there are a number of places throughout Porter County where residents can bring in their smoke detectors for recycling. And that's any time. We're bringing this up because people are really conscious of replacing their batteries at this time of year. So again, if you notice it doesn't function or if it's 10 years or older, you can always bring it into a number of places to be recycled. And we ask that it be recycled because smoke detectors have a small amount of radioactive material, and that's what detects the smoke. So we don't necessarily want you to throw that in your garbage can where it can be crushed and that radioactive material gets out, and it could potentially have negative effects to humans or to the environment. But recycling it means that that material is segregated and sent to a special waste fill. And also the hard plastic case and the other metals are also recycled. So this recycling program ensures that the radioactive material is managed properly.
And I know that you have a number of organizations that support this idea of not only checking the batteries, but checking the data, so to speak, on the smoke detector and replacing it with a new unit. There are a number of groups out there in Porter County that are very supportive of your idea.
Well, yes, and the Porter County Fire Association recommends that you replace smoke detectors every 10 years. And we have partnered with a number of fire and EMS departments throughout Porter County so that people can bring in their smoke detectors to be recycled. For instance, the Chesterton Fire Department, the Porter Fire Department, the Valparaiso Fire Department Station 2, Ogden Dunes Fire Department, Lakes of the Four Seasons Volunteer Fire Force, South Haven Fire Department, Hebron Fire Department, and also the Porter EMS Station in Hebron. Those are all places where people can take their smoke detector.
Wow, it's just about every place in Porter County you can. There isn't a township that probably isn't covered, or you can't take an old smoke detector too and not have it properly handled.
Exactly. And also, we are accepting them at the Valparaiso compost site and the Boone Grove compost site. So if you're going to either one of those locations to carry on business, you can bring those and we'll accept them there as well. So there's a lot of places that are convenient for anybody in Porter County.
Now that brings up our next topic that we haven't talked about for a while, and something that folks this time of year are certainly interested in is handling your fall yard waste and how to get it composted. And of course there are the permanent sites that are set up in Porter County and some other opportunities as well too. Tell us about the wide variety of yard waste you can have recycled by having it composted.
Oh, absolutely. If people cannot compost in their backyards, but they have yard waste, and it can be leaves and dead plants and grass and fall decorations, like all your old pumpkins and gourds and mums and corn stalks, and all those things are organic. So we accept those at the Valparaiso compost site and the Boone Grove compost site. And also tree limbs and logs and things like that. The pumpkins and the gourds, we put those in and those become compost. And those, the compost will be available in the spring for all of your plantings. The branches definitely will become mulch, and that those will be available in the spring. And of course, the logs, people take firewood from the compost site, and that's free to all Porter County residents. So we ask people to bring in the material, and then once it becomes compost and becomes mulch, they can take that for all of their plantings and such in the growing season. So it's recycling at its best.
Now, there are a couple of dates we probably should mention as a side note here about the composting operations in Porter County. Some dates that people should know about here if they have material that they want to take. Just remember that the sites are going to be closed for holidays and the like, and it won't be long, I guess, where the composting site will be closed for the season, won't it?
That's right. One thing's for certain is the compost sites are closed for the entire Thanksgiving holiday weekend. So that's from Thanksgiving Thursday to Sunday. So that's 4 days that both sites will not be operational. And they will both be closing. Their last day of operation is December 1st, which is a Saturday. So, the season is ending quickly. So if you're doing some yard cleanup, please, don't wait and bring in the material sooner than later.
One of the other things I know that is out there, too, that you can find if you go on to PorterCountyRecycling.org is an interesting blog that's on the website. And we've talked here, I guess, about dealing with your post-Halloween pumpkins and your live fall decorations. But you have some great ideas, too, I guess. One in particular, I never really thought about the opportunity that maybe you should take in recycling your candy wrappers. Are there recyclable candy wrappers out there? I never really thought about it.
Well, that's just it. We talk about here at the Solid Waste District, we talk about recycling inside your bin, your curbside bin or at our drop-off locations, versus recycling outside the curbside bin. And those are very, very different. So candy wrappers, you should never put at your curbside bin because they're not acceptable at where the materials get sorted. So there are only certain materials that you want to put in your curbside bin,
mm-hmm.
and that includes like cans, metal, you know, those kinds of metals, plastic tubs, jugs, and bottles only, glass, and what am I missing? Cartons, and of course, paper and cardboard. So those are, that's what's acceptable curbside. So candy wrappers, yes, because Halloween's coming and the kids are going to have tons and tons of candy wrappers. You can't put those curbside because then that becomes contamination. But a recent recycling program has been undertaken by Subaru in partnership with TerraCycle. And if you take your candy wrappers to a Subaru dealer, and there's one in Portage and there's one in Merrillville, they are accepting those hard-to-recycle waste. So like candy wrappers, they're also accepting K-cups because those are not acceptable curbside. And they're also accepting single-use plastic cups like Solo cups or coffee cups that you get at Dunkin' Donuts or Starbucks. So those are waste that can't be recycled curbside. And now Subaru has an opportunity for people that want to recycle these types of materials to just bring them into the Subaru dealership in Merrillville and Portage.
Well, Donna, that's
all
great
very
news.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's great
yeah.
news. Well, there's a lot more we can talk about. In fact, some other things I didn't want to bring up here after we get into the 1st of November. So we will have you back on to talk about these things. Donna, thank you very much for spending time with us today to bring up these items in particular.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.